Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do. My guest this week is actor, writer, and director Noel Clarke, whom you've seen on the telly in Alf Wiedersen Pet, Chasing Shadows, and probably most likely as Rose Tyler's boyfriend Mickey on Doctor Who. He's also been building an impressive film career in movies like Heartless, Centurion, and Star Trek Into Darkness, and as the writer, co-star, and subsequently director of the Kidulthood series, the latest installment of which, Brotherhood, brought Noel to TIFF earlier this month. Noel picked Pulp Fiction, and if I have to explain that movie to you, well, we're going to have a problem. Quentin Tarantino's 1994 follow-up to his breakout debut, Reservoir Dogs, was everything we wanted it to be. A complex, layered, chronologically playful, absolutely exhilarating deconstruction of genre with vivid characters and dialogue that's just a pleasure to hear. It's the movie that reminded us John Travolta could be cool, the movie that gave us the perfect expressions of Samuel L. Jackson and Ving Rhames, the movie that started the absolutely electrifying screen partnership of Quentin Tarantino and Uma Thurman, and also Bruce Willis is in it. But you know all that, right? Of course you do. This is someone else's movie.
Why did I pick Pulp Fiction? Because it was... I think I was 17 at the time. Maybe 18. And it just... Pulp Fiction spoke to me in a way that other films hadn't spoken to me before. I was in media class in high school, I guess it's called here. Because it wasn't universities, it wasn't college. And the teacher was bringing films in and he said, oh, you guys need to watch this film. We were supposed to be studying, like, I don't know, Shakespeare in Love or something. I don't remember. And Kevin Smith films had always been my favourite. You know, Clerks and Mallrats and sure. Chasing Amy and stuff. Because they were, you know, talking how people spoke. And then the media teacher was like, you guys need to watch this, Pulp Fiction. I'm like, Pulp Fiction? What is this? Who's this guy? I don't remember seeing Reservoir Dogs. I think because I was so young when it had come out, like 15, it kind of just had passed me by. And so, you know, we went and got the video, still VHS,
sure.
You know, Pulp Fiction, put it in, watched it, and it just blew my mind. It was a film told out of sequence, and up until that point, I hadn't seen it. I didn't know you could do that. I didn't know you could do what you wanted to do. I thought films were like, you start at the beginning, you get to the middle, oh, there's a problem, they solve the problem, and at the end. I probably wasn't even that up on the intelligence and the construction of movies. But, I mean, it obviously has those beats, but, you know, and I'd love to see it in chronological order one day. I don't think I've ever done that. But watching that film told out of order just really blew my mind. And at that point, I was like, okay, that's what I want to do. If you can do that, I didn't know you could. I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah.
And I remember my teacher said, and I still speak to this media teacher, I still speak to him to this day. I said, sir, I didn't know you could do that. And he said, think about film so you can do what you want. And I just, even now I say it, like I get like a chill in my neck because I just was like, what? And that's the thing that really made me go, I'm going to make films too.
It is hard to explain to people now that, you know, like, oh, 1994 is not that long ago, but
no.
Structure was in American film. I mean, maybe sometimes you had a science fiction movie that ended where it began,
yeah.
Or
yeah.
You'd have a, you know, Pinter's Betrayal, which is told backwards.
Yeah. Yes.
But the conceit defines the thing, and yeah. In Pulp Fiction, it really is so off the cuff about it.
Off the cuff, man. Just absolutely.
Yeah, here, this movie's not going to make sense right away. Just, you know,
just sit with
enjoy it.
It. And I did a film like that a few years later, which 4321.
Right, title I couldn't remember.
Yeah, with directed Emma Roberts, and you know that film, Pulp Fiction and Go, the Doug Liman film Go, were films that really inspired me to do 4321. You know, because I just loved it. I loved it. It's like, man, you got to sit with this movie. You have to watch it from beginning to end, and then go, I get it.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, and it's, again, now that so much of what he did is mainstream,
yeah,
it's harder to... It's funny, I was explaining this to somebody, or I was defending my own opinion to somebody. It's harder to explain why Tarantino was so important in 94 now that he is... Everybody's ripping him off, and he's not really operating at the same level that
he's not doing what he used to do. I mean, his dialogue can still be great, if not a little bit overwritten, you know, and that's... You know, if he gave me that dialogue, I would be damn sure taking it. Like, it's not a criticism. I love that. I love him as a filmmaker,
yeah.
And would love the opportunity to work with him. But, you know, his early stuff is just unbelievable.
Yeah.
Like, it's just genius.
Yeah. I saw Reservoir Dogs, and this is not an exaggeration, 5 times the first day I saw it.
Wow.
Because I got a tape of it at TIFF, in fact, before it was even TIFF. It was the Festival of Festivals in 1992, and the studio that was distributing, 92, by the way, was the best year for the festival.
Yeah.
We had that, we had The Crying Game, we had Bad Lieutenant, Peter Jackson's Brain Dead, Candyman was here.
Clerks in 92?
Clerks was 93. It was the following year. Right. It was at Sundance first,
right.
So
yeah.
We missed it. But the studio that had Reservoir Dogs also had Strictly Ballroom.
Yeah.
And back then, press coverage was small enough that they were chasing anybody who would pay attention who was in town. And I was writing for the Toronto Star, and they gave me the distributor, CFP, I think it was called then, just gave me these 2 tapes, Strictly Ballroom. And
check this out.
Watch these. The directors are in town tomorrow and come back. And I stayed home and watched Reservoir Dogs over and over.
And just like, what the
Yeah, I'd never seen...
Yeah.
I had seen films like it because I was a little familiar with Hong Kong cinema.
Yeah.
But it hit me like a bag of hammers. It was just this incredible infusion. And so when Pulp Fiction came out, I was 1994, I would have been 26, and I was so excited.
Yeah.
And it played Cannes, and we sort of heard the news. Back then, there was no news, really.
Yeah,
it took months to hear about stuff.
Yeah.
And then here's the new Quentin Tarantino film, go see it at 10 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And I think I was so excited. And then to have it pay off and be better and more intricate.
Yeah.
And the film, it's the film you want the first timer to make the second time out.
Exactly. Exactly that, you know, and I think it was just brilliant. I would argue still to this day that it's the best one.
I'm torn, honestly.
Reservoir.
I think Reservoir Dogs, it's structurally, it's perfect, and it's got no fat on it, none.
Yeah.
And Pulp Fiction, I do love it, but I like there's stuff on rewatch that are just like, okay.
Yeah, but you know what, he's the master of that, and I've adopted that as well. He's the master of having scenes in the film that don't move the story forward.
That's true.
And I love that. Because I think in real life, not everything moves our story forward.
Sure.
And so I get it. You want a tight cut, and you want to make sure you have a number of minutes. But he does, you know, all that Royale with Chief, all that stuff, you could cut that right down, and you could get to the chase where they go into the apartment and deal with those boys. But that texture, that extra stuff, which I do now in my films, is just sometimes it's just needed for levity, for breathing space, for just that relatable conversation that you might have with your friends, that someone goes, oh yeah, and this happened, that happened, and it doesn't move the story forward, and someone in the audience just goes, remember that was us. You know, those moments, you know,
people,
I love.
Yeah, people don't realize, and again, I'm going to say this a lot for this movie because I'm old and cranky, but people, kids today, they don't understand that in 1994, the idea of a movie where gangsters had inner lives and digressive conversations rather than being the hoods who show up at the beginning and the end.
Was groundbreaking.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
It's more the butch stuff that I could do without, which is weird because I love Willis in the role, but the whole I'm an American, our names don't mean shit. It's a long way to go for a punchline.
Yeah.
And it still works, but it kind of also shows you where he's going to end up as Tarantino as a screenwriter, where we're going to talk about stuff for half an hour and maybe it'll have some
germane
connection too. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true, actually. You look at that written.
But I still... Pulp Fiction, I'll still love it because it is comfort food now. It's
I wish you would make another one.
Yeah. Were you one of the people who wanted the Vega Brothers movie? Because I remember there was talk about that.
I wasn't one of the people that wanted the Vega Brothers movie, but as I've got older and, you know, especially as I've done this, and I just like, man, I would love him to just go, all right, what's Jules Winfield and everyone doing now? I'd love to see a new one. Is Jules got a son?
Is Jules walking the earth?
Probably, because I want to play the son. You know, that's probably my agenda with it all.
I could see that.
Because I would absolutely love to be in the Tarantino movie. And again, I think the fact that I find that one the most grounded and the one I like the most makes me kind of subconsciously go, Pulp Fiction 2, me as the son, Afro wig, love it.
We'll put it out there.
Yeah.
Well, it would be present day, presumably. So you could do almost...
Yeah.
You know, the closest he's come to a present day movie, I guess, is Death Proof.
Yeah.
Which takes place in our, like, Kill Bill's contemporary.
Yeah.
But all of his films, they harken back, you know, they pull to different eras. Pulp Fiction feels like it came out of the 70s.
Yeah.
In a weird way.
Yeah, it does feel like that. But I guess it was contemporary at the time of 93 or whatever it was.
Sure,
94. Death Proof.
It does have that amazing. I in fact, I just tweeted about this so people know more or less when we're recording this. But it was on cable. There are a number of cable stations in Toronto, at least, that just repeat
Yeah. So it was on, Pulp Fiction was on from 9 to midnight and then midnight to 3.
Fantastic.
And I caught, my wife and I had finished watching something else and it came on.
Yeah.
And we caught the final sequence.
Yeah.
Which picks up with, you know,
Amanda Plummer.
Pleased to meet you, Mr. Wolf. All of that. Like the, ending scene. You know, this guy respects the job.
Yeah.
So that, the entire final diner sequence with Pumpkin and Honey Bunny.
Yeah.
And Jules and God, Vincent. So
Bacon,
I'm sorry, yeah. I'm so tired.
That's all right.
Week
man,
of this yeah. festival. And so we watched the end, and then the beginning came right up again, and yeah. it was amazing. I'd never had that opportunity.
Yeah.
To sort of just watch those two segments and yeah. how they're knitted together and how they're different.
Yeah.
And just to revel in the structure, the audacity to beginning a 2.5 hour movie with this long conversation between yeah. characters we yeah. will not see again.
Yes. Amazing.
For 2.5 hours.
Amazing.
And he wrote, this was this is the quintessential Tarantino thing. He wrote character dialogue in character. He doesn't do that anymore these
yeah.
days. Like, everyone sounds like Quentin.
Yes.
And in Pulp Fiction, you have four distinct characters who all have their own, they have their own opinions, they have their own agendas, they yeah. have their own motivations, and they're so just pleasurable to listen
pleasurable,
to.
Pleasurable, amazing. And I think that's the hunger, though, isn't it? You know, he was young and hungry at the time, and you know, didn't have, you know, still had bills to pay, probably. You know what I mean? And there's an element of the work that goes in, and you know, when things change, sometimes it's just like, I'm just gonna write this script, and it doesn't always. Great concepts, like, you know, I love the concept of Inglourious, I love the concept of Hateful Eight and stuff like that. But then sometimes I'm like, yeah, you know, and I almost want to go, just reset, Quentin, man, go do something grounded, do something grounded, do like now. Contemporary, like you used to do, and just bring it home, you know?
Yeah. It is such a satisfying film in that, you know, half the characters end up dead. People die.
Yeah.
People die terribly.
Yeah.
It's violent. It's brutal.
Yeah.
It's racist. It's sexist. All of
yeah.
it. But it is so much damage.
Things that my film sometimes get accused of.
Well, but the intention is not...
Yeah.
I mean, as in yours, the intention is not exploitative. It's
no.
about kind of... Well, for Tarantino, it's absolutely about celebrating the elements of blaxploitation culture and
yeah.
the things he grew up loving.
Yeah.
And for your films, my sense is that it's simply...
It's
the characters in them don't think they're being
100%
racist.
Yeah. 100%, you know. Or, you know, when you get a character like Daly, he probably knows he is, but it's like that's how he was raised. He's, you know, if you could see a film about Daly and his family, that's probably how they all are.
Mm-hmm.
So he's raised like that. And, you know, you kind of have the elements of... You know, the things that happen and the things that we see in the film, they happen in real life. You know, yeah. and the real life informs the... You know, it's funny how many... There's been quite a few comments of like, oh, there's loads of naked women and there's a brothel, the gangster runs a brothel and this is ridiculous. It's like, well, there are brothels run by pimps. You know, there's yeah. one in the middle of Soho in London, which is the film district. So, and no police are shutting it down. So, I mean, if... How can we complain about it on cinema when, you know, we walk past it every day?
Yeah.
You know, so it's that kind of thing. And I think Quentin's film, well, Pulp Fiction definitely, you know, it highlighted the fact that we do see on the news, oh, three men found dead in an apartment and such, and we all go, oh, that's terrible, and we carry on about our day. But, you know, we don't think it could be Vincent Vega and Jules Winfield going to look for the suitcase for their boss, and they do. Like, it happens, you
yeah.
know? And
well, I mean, it happens, but God doesn't always get involved.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a much
yeah.
larger story
yeah, exactly.
happening that people are missing. But I guess what I can always go with is the sense that the cinema, that the film is telling me it knows
yes.
what's going on.
Yes.
That it's aware. The characters yeah. might not be.
But the film
But the movie knows. And
yeah.
that's, I mean, maybe, and unfortunately it's Tarantino's own character where he gives himself that entire speech.
Yeah,
that's where it gets.
Yeah, that's the bit you kind of want to forward, but
yeah.
you're like,
But that's the bit where I find it. It's almost fascinating to try to figure out: does he think it's okay, or is he seizing the opportunity to be the guy who says it? And like nobody.
Yeah.
There was a live reading. A friend of mine, Chandler Levesque, who's actually done the podcast. She did an episode about Can't Hardly Wait.
Okay, great. Yeah.
Really good one. She does live readings, and she does feminist live readings where she'll recast entire male narratives with female actors.
Wow. Yeah,
and great. She did Reservoir Dogs, and the woman playing Mr. Pink had a little trouble with the N-word dropping.
Yeah.
And I think he's the only character in the film who does it, and she was really clearly, she went with it, but it was not comfortable to the point where yeah. everyone kind of had to comment on it. At the beginning and say, yeah. we're keeping the dialogue, that's how it goes.
Yeah.
But
Tarantino himself sees the opportunity, I think that's where it gets a little pricklier.
Yeah, it's just about whether he was, you know, the one thing I've realized making films is sometimes you just do things and then people often go, I know why he did that. He did it because of this. And you're like, well, no, I that's not really why I just did it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it takes on a life of its own. So it is interesting about what you say. Was he seizing the opportunity to be the person that said it, or did he just think it was okay? Right. Did he still want to do a Spike Lee and act? You know, did he just want to act and be in the movies? You know,
and this is the role.
And this was the role, you know, and it's just, we'll never know, I guess, because he'll never say it. But
yeah, we've talked around it a couple of times, him and me.
Yeah, really? Yeah. Oh,
he's
man.
A great interview, but there's stuff he doesn't want to go into.
Yeah, I think, I mean, and again, you know, I probably ruined my chances, but I think it's the former. I think he just wanted to still be in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he thought about it. I think both him and I, in these types of films, have the same, like Heath Ledger says it best in The Dark Knight. He says, I just do things.
Yeah.
I'm like a dog chasing a car. I wouldn't know what to do if I caught one. And I don't feel for a second that Quentin was like, right, I'm going to say this political statement and I'm going to be the man that says it. And the irony of the white man saying these lines. Right. I don't think any of that. I think he was like, okay, I'm not going to play any of the leads. There's this little role. These are the lines. I'll take it. That's it. Didn't think anything of it. It's when it gets exposed to the world and people's like, oh, well, it becomes a thing on its own. And then he doesn't want to comment. And it's the same thing, you know. People say to me, I had an interview today, someone said, so when you did this and it related to this, this, and this, and how do you feel about the way that that's perceived? And I just went, well, I didn't plan that. That wasn't I just did it.
Right.
You know?
Were they your own films he was talking about? Or
yeah, it was my film. I can't remember the situation, but it was my film.
Well, so the instinct, I mean, for myself, speaking as a critic, the instinct is always to connect the dots because even if you're not doing it consciously, then there's something in you that's pulling you towards this stuff, which I find the most interesting thing about cinema, about people telling stories, is that you can never get away from who you are and what you want people to care about.
That's right.
So I'm always going to do that, but in that's other cases, I was talking to Jonah Hill just last month about War Dogs, and we came, and my line of connection was Moneyball and Wolf of Wall Street, and this people seem to think that he's the guy who can make exposition entertaining,
because
they're giving him all these huge data dumps, all these numbers, and all these factors and figures, and he just said, I just thought the movies were good.
Like,
I know, but you still took them. Yeah, so let's talk about this.
Let's talk about this. Yeah, that's interesting. And he had no awareness of the fact that his characters are the ones that do all the data dumps and all that.
He claimed he was unaware.
It's interesting.
Yeah, he said they were just a bunch of movies he made a couple of years apart, and he didn't really give much thought to it. And it's like, okay, but people thought of you for the parts. Yeah. Well, that's not really how I see it. And I get it. I mean, you can only perceive what you perceive, right? Like his world, he's probably turning down more scripts a day than he says yes to or develops.
Yeah.
So,
but that is interesting.
But he still picked him, right? Yeah. So he's still, there is a
commitment. There's something that's making him there. There's something that he finds within those scripts that makes him want to pick those movies.
Yeah. Like with Tarantino, with Pulp Fiction, absolutely. It's a celebration of the movies he loved and the books that he flipped through and the covers, I think, more than the books themselves. Yeah. And he's given inner lives to all of these one-dimensional, two-dimensional characters, hoodlums and harlots and victims, I think is how people describe them at the time in the pulp age. But there is so much life. Just Eric Stoltz eating Fruit Brute, the cereal, which had gone out of production, I believe. They actually had to go and find boxes or make them to let him eat them because it made sense in the scene that this guy would still be eating his childhood cereal because he's not grown up yet. Rosanna Arquette, who has virtually no dialogue, but is totally lived in. That role is like, I know who that
Everything
person is.
Everything pissed and like, get out here!
And the glee when the needle comes out, like, there's so much. That's who she is.
She's like, oh man, I'm a fucking trip or whatever she says.
And Pumpkins, Ringo's, whoever you want to call him, Tim Roth's cell phone joke, the thing at the beginning, because I hadn't really caught that.
Who's the Amanda Plummer?
Right, Honey Bunny.
Sorry,
He's telling her the story about guy walks into a bank holding up a cell phone.
Yeah.
And then at the very end, when he's collecting the loot, going through everybody's wallets, he says, is that a cellular phone? Put it in the bag.
Yeah.
And it's just, I had never seen the ending before the beginning so closely and realized that that's a 2.5 hour setup for that joke.
Yeah.
Which only
works
if you care, if you've been paying attention.
Yeah, great.
And he's so good at that.
He's so good at it. So good at it. He was better, though. He was better.
The Roth better than Plummer?
No, sorry, Tarantino was better at that.
Oh, at the time?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Now we get stuff like, I mean, The Hateful Eight, which is this fascinating kind of mirror image of Reservoir Dogs, because again, it's locked room film with a prologue and an epilogue and a couple of flashbacks.
Yeah.
It is the same structure, which is kind of fascinating, except that it's twice as long as it needs to be. Yeah. It's shot in 70mm and it's exhausting. And
I still enjoyed it because it's Tarantino, but yes.
There's stuff in it.
It's one of those ones you watch it and you go, come on, Tarantino. Come on, Quentin. Come on, Quentin. And at the end, you're like, okay, man. Okay. Yeah. Next one. The next one's going to be the next one will be our one.
But we'll still come back. Like, 100%. Like, you hate Tarantino. It's like, no, I keep going. I keep going to his movies.
I love Tarantino. Anything he does, I'm watching. You know, I just want to see Pulp Fiction again.
So, as far as that goes, how often do you? I mean, do you retreat back to it? Do you come back to it like comfort food?
I mean, I have the VHS still. I have probably 3 DVDs. You know, one special edition I was given recently after the 20 years or something like that,
and,
or 25 years maybe. 25?
No, almost 94. So we're coming up on it.
So I was given
probably the 20th anniversary.
The 20th anniversary special collection DVD with a book and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, and anytime if it's on, I'm flicking. It's on. I'm watching it. Without fail, you know, and I can recite that film probably back to front. You know, I just love it. I just love it. I loved everything about it, and it's literally, you know, my other, you know, because when they ask me, I'm always you know, because Go is one of my favorites.
Right.
Amelie, French film.
Oh yeah, sure.
Absolutely loved that movie. Clerks, you know, so that, and Et Mama Timbi, and those kind of are the five that, you know, if depending on my mood, I'll kind of. But generally, Pulp Fiction is the one, is the number one. Whatever, man. I just really, really, really think there was so much in there that just unlocked my mind as a young person, as an actor.
Yeah.
You know, seeing Samuel L. Jackson there, and, you know, I'm not his biggest fan, but seeing Samuel L. Jackson there in a role that wasn't... Oh, well, that's wrong. It was a gangster, but wasn't a typical gangster that we were used to seeing at the time. You know, he wore a suit. Like, our guys were like, you got a problem? Like, they didn't wear suits. It was like, whoa, this guy has a suit and he's cool.
Right.
And he recites the Bible. That's awesome. You know, and it was just different. So seeing someone of color do that was like, wow. You know, John Travolta coming back, you know, after doing Look Who's Talking Now. I believe that was the last thing I saw him in when dogs were speaking to him or something like that.
Yeah, that was a dark time.
Yeah.
I mean, Travolta's one of those fascinating cases, too, because he'll have a renaissance every 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think he's ever going to have another better one than this.
Yeah.
Because somehow, and he's doing it with Jackson, too, with the hair and the mutton chops.
Yeah.
And he's creating a version of Samuel Jackson that never existed.
Yeah.
But he's letting him play him again.
Yeah.
And with Travolta, he is playing the Travolta that we knew, the one I grew up with in the 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
The kind of slick, handsome, terrifyingly poised, physically interesting person.
Yeah.
But going to seed and on heroin with a weird haircut.
Exactly.
It's like an alternate reality where it didn't happen for him.
Exactly.
And those are just the ones in the first 5 minutes. Yeah. I mean, we barely touched on Ving. We didn't even mention Ving Rhames.
Ving Rhames, yeah.
But as a completely different gangster of color,
who's
almost recognizable. I mean, this is a couple of years after Boys in the Hood.
He's the boss, though.
But he is, yeah.
And he's cool and calm and
terrifying, you know,
terrifying with his stillness and his quiet. And you're so used to just seeing black guys go, "You motherfucker! I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna do that." And actually, he was just like, "Chill the fuck out."
Yeah.
Go back inside. And you're just like, wow. You know, and the plaster on the back of the neck is like iconic. Like,
which apparently was just there. The story goes that he wrote it into it. The other thing about Pulp Fiction, of course, is that because we never see what's in the box, what's in the briefcase, which Sam Jackson said was just two lights and a battery.
Yeah.
There are endless theories about what it is.
Yeah.
And one of the big ones is that it's Marcellus's soul. Because supposedly the devil can take your soul through the back of your neck, which is what the Band-Aid represents.
Right, right.
None of that is in the text.
Yeah, of course, it's just something.
Rhames had a Band-Aid on and said, "Should I take it off?" And turns, he's like, "Nah, it looks cool."
Yeah, exactly.
And
exactly.
It became a thing.
And exactly, people start going, "It's the soul, and it's this, that, and the other." I mean, yeah, it's amazing. I love that films take on a life of their own afterwards in terms of people doing that. But yeah, Ving Rhames, you know. Mm. Doing that thing again, you know, it was the boss. It was something not to aspire to, but to go, wow, I didn't know we could do that.
Yeah.
I didn't know we were allowed, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, you know? the equivalent in the US at the time was stuff like New Jack City.
Yeah.
Where it's not
Juice,
yeah, that's true. Yeah. That would have been 91.
Poetic Justice, all that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Films that sort of played up South Central Los Angeles and your conventional drug dealing crime stuff, which, you know, The Wire 20 years later would come along, or 10 years later would come along and undercut and deconstruct that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think the universe that Tarantino is playing with is entirely cinematic.
Mm.
So he's offering a window that hadn't existed before.
Yeah.
And creating this kind of weird power culture where people can do anything and be anybody as long as they're cool.
Yes.
That's his thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, they were all cool.
Yeah.
That was the thing. They were all cool, you know. And just, you know, again, having the Bruce Willis character, having the French girlfriend.
Mm, Maria de Medeiros.
Yeah, it was like, I wasn't seeing this stuff at the time, you know. I wasn't seeing a lot of this stuff, and it just, it just opened my mind.
Yeah, it feels like an art house lift, kind of, in a way. They're just sort of pulling stuff. He's pulling stuff from even Godard and Truffaut, where characters are fascinated by Americans and attracted to them that way.
Yeah.
But it has its own weird life.
Yeah.
As soon as they show up in the movie, even Christopher Walken's bizarre monologue.
Yeah, and I had this uncle piecing metal up my ass.
Yeah.
For 5 years.
Yeah. And his delivery, like, there are directors who can dictate performance, and then if you cast Christopher Walken, he gives you what he wants to
do. And he's brave, you know. Tarantino's brave in Pulp Fiction. Actually, whether it was bravery or inexperience, but, like, he doesn't move the camera a lot.
No, that single take, too, with Walken.
He doesn't move the camera a hell of a lot, and I think now that would be considered a brave choice. Maybe it was inexperience, I don't know, but it definitely gives it a style that, you know, that I like, you know.
Yeah. Well, there's more predatory kind of action in Reservoir Dogs just to keep the suspense going, because it's a single location and he has to move it a lot.
Yeah.
There are a lot of whip pens, I remember.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is
good for the edit.
Yeah, it feels like a deliberate choice in Pulp Fiction to be locked down and
static and you know, really interesting.
And then it pays off with stuff, you know, things like the shot through the windshield when Butch comes up and sees Marcellus crossing the road.
Yes, yeah.
You've got that amazing long play out in widescreen of the reactions happening in the moment.
Yeah, that was amazing.
Yeah, and then that takes us somewhere else that the movie had not gone to before. You've already had impalements and drug overdoses and all of this, and then, Southern... Gimp raping,
yeah.
Rapists,
yeah.
I suppose.
The one thing I remember mostly about this scene, or the end of that scene, the beginning of that scene, for some reason, is the fact we hadn't really seen it before, was innocent bystander getting shot. That lady in the white shorts.
Yeah.
That lady in the white shorts takes a shot in the leg, and that stuck with me. Always stuck. I can see her black long hair now. Like, it's always stuck with me, and it was something I just found interesting, because up until that point, it was cool. Everything was cool.
Yeah.
And then you start to realize, oh my God, these guys are still gangsters. And suddenly a member of the public just minding their own business has been shot in the leg.
Yeah. Collateral damage. And
collateral damage. And it was weird, because he didn't need to, you know, it's an extra, an essay. He didn't need to put it in. And, you know, maybe I'm doing the classic thing that I say, but I read more into it. I read more like it was almost a reminder of, like, this isn't as cool as you...
Yeah, oh, I agree. I absolutely think that's intentional. I mean, he does it in Reservoir Dogs, too, when Mr. Orange shoots the woman to get her car.
Mm.
She shoots him first, but he shoots her.
Yeah, exactly.
And
exactly. So I'm just like, you know, that woman goes down, and then you have, Zed.
Yeah.
Zed and whatever. I don't know what the other guy was called, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a bit freaky, that part, but...
Yeah, and that's Peter Green, too, who is just one of the creepier actors at the time. He was in a film called Clean Shaven that Lodge Kerrigan made. That,
right, I remember.
You see him in that, and you just spend the rest of his career watching him going, oh, okay, yeah, I can't, I can't totally trust him.
Yeah, he's
Maybe playing a man with a dog, but he's got a gun somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
And he shows up in this, and it's. I have this rule, the Peter Mullen effect, which is if Peter Mullen shows up in a film, things are only going to get worse for people.
Yeah.
Again, he's a lovely man. We've talked, but I've never talked to him about this thing.
Yeah.
But even in, you know, like in Children
it
of
might,
Men,
if you mention it to him, it might get worse for you.
I'm curious.
Yeah.
I've already met him, though, so nothing can save
him. Yeah.
But, you know, in Children of Men, he's in, like, 100 minutes into this incredible dystopian, angry, awful picture. Yeah. He shows up, more people die.
More people die, it's just how it works. Yeah.
But Peter Green has that power in this film, in Pulp Fiction, when you see him and you're just like, oh, shit, well, whatever's happening, it's going to get
worse. It's going to get worse.
Yeah.
I mean, it sure does, man.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But then it becomes a film, but I think that's where the movie starts tilting towards redemption.
Yeah.
And what Tarantino's genius despite everything else that's genius-y about the film, his recontextualization of the metaphors and the tropes of Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
He does it in Reservoir Dogs, too. He shows you what happens when bad people have a choice to be good.
Yes.
Or even when good people have a choice to do bad, yeah, which is Butch's problem.
Yeah.
It's where it gets really complex. This situation, everything in Butch's life gets easier if he just lets things happen.
Yeah.
And he doesn't.
No, he doesn't.
And everything in Jules' life would be easier if he lets things happen.
Yeah.
And he doesn't. And the idea that the film builds emotional momentum in the midst of this tornado of violence and retribution.
Yeah.
I was so thrilled to watch this thing start asking these questions.
Yeah.
In the middle of all of this. Because you're given, what, a good 100 minutes, 110 minutes of just pure pleasure, violence and silliness and, yeah, and all of it. And then suddenly it's like, oh yeah, but what if it matters?
Yeah, that's interesting. That is interesting. You're right. You know, he just, Butch's character, you're right, because he just doesn't let things lie. He could just leave the damn thing. He could just, you know.
Yeah. And that's what's so great about Bruce Willis, is he's actually pissed at himself in that moment for making that that choice. He's like, oh,
yeah.
He has to go back and save the day.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, your films are aware of this, too. I mean, you create worlds where people are given choices constantly, and they're the product of their environments, but they can choose to leave.
They can, yeah. They can try to leave. You know, again, you know, Brotherhood, you know, the latest one is the same thing. You know, I was talking about it earlier. You know, when, you know, if I'm Sam, it's Noel that gets that postcard and says, come to the address, I'm not going. Mm. Like, I'm not going. There's nothing that makes me go. I'm, like, calling the police, and I'm trying to live as good a life as I can, because it's been 10 years since I've been in that sort of trouble. But Sam just can't let it go.
Yeah.
He cannot let it go. He's like, all right, I need to go and see what this is. You know, who walks into a house like that? But Sam does, because that's like, that character was defined from the very first film, when he was very reactive and like, they did something, so I'm coming to get you, you know. And that, it was like, you know, going through the change in adulthood and even the beginning of this film, but you're still who you are.
Yeah.
When it starts to come, it starts to bubble up under the surface, you're still who you are, you know. And you're right, you're completely right, you know, attributing it, the same sort of characteristics to the my films and this thing is like, that character just can't let it go.
Yeah. I think, you know, the scariest thing in fiction is to be confronted with the fact that we are who we are, and we always will be.
Yes, yeah.
The product of our environment, but also we assume, you know, everybody learns to be an adult by mimicking. You just assume the role, you do the thing you think will do. It's that great Noah Baumbach line from Kicking and Screaming, affectations become habits. You are this person eventually.
Yes.
But to be confronted with a choice like that, I mean, we almost never get that. That's what makes movies so great.
That's what makes movies so great. Exactly. And it's, that is really interesting.
Yeah.
Because again, you know, sometimes, you know, it takes sitting down with someone like yourself for me to go, oh, yeah, actually, you know, even within my work, like, I hadn't thought of that. And then when you say, it's, you know, these things happen, I go, yeah, well, maybe that is subconsciously, that was that, you know. But again, I think that, much like myself in my earlier work, I think, you know, it's easy to look at it after and put reasons in.
Sure.
Whereas actually, we as filmmakers sometimes just do them, or we think we just do them.
Right.
Because like you said, our subconscious is informing us. The way we were raised is informing us. But we sometimes forget that, and we just go, well, I just did that.
Yeah. Well, you're following an intuition, which is shaped by who you are.
Shaped by who you are, yeah.
And what you perceive around you, and what you have to work with, too.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, Tarantino reaching for bigger things now, trying to make the Italian Django. Spaghetti Western Django films, and turn them into a story about a slave named Django who is bought and freed and rebels.
Yeah.
Maybe overreaching, but it's what he's working with. Like, it's what he knows and what he wants to do.
Yeah.
And I think it happens in The Hateful Eight, it happens in Inglourious Basterds. He wants to make the kind of movies he grew up seeing, but he can't help but filter them into something bigger and more important.
Yeah.
That's what he wants to do.
That's what he wants to do, yeah, exactly.
So there is no small
like
turn.
He's like movie. Trying to correct social injustice within his movies, you know,
in Inglourious. In the 1860s. And, sure. Oh, God, like, he wins World War II.
Yeah.
Or kills Hitler.
Yeah, exactly.
Changes time.
Yeah, you kind of like, well, that didn't happen, but you're just kind of into it. But, you know, it just eats away at you, because you know that the real story was so much horrible, much worse and horrible.
Mm.
You know, and it's the same with Django. You know, you kind of like, you're watching, and it's, you know, somewhere Quentin's going, you know, that's an injustice. What happened to those people was an injustice. I'm going to do this film.
Right.
And, you know, the interesting thing is like, whether he thinks it's okay that he does it,
Yeah.
Or if he just feels he's correcting a social injustice the way he wants to do. You know?
I'm fascinated by his sense of... It's because it's not entitlement, I don't think. I think he legitimately believes he has something to say.
I agree.
And wants to say it, not that he deserves to say it. And then he gets distracted by what could be cool.
Yeah.
Like, by what could be awesomer.
Yeah.
In Inglorious Bastards, that's, well, you kill Hitler. That's what you do.
Exactly.
USA, you can't help himself.
Yeah.
But that conflict is really interesting to me. Not necessarily in the moment of watching the 3 hours of The Hateful Eight, but coming out of it and thinking, he kind of did do Reservoir Dogs and The Thing.
It kind of did upset me when he got all the flack he got for Django, from black filmmakers, because, you know, I feel like his heart was pure. Mm. I feel like he thought he was like, social injustice, this happened, it was the worst thing that's happened in American history, I'm going to write this film and I'm going to make it right how I wish it was. And a lot of people are like, hold on, you ain't got the right to be doing this shit, man. And you ain't got the right to be using that word and saying this and that. And I think I felt bad for him because I feel like he meant well.
Yeah, that was the last time we actually talked, the last interview with him that I did, and it's a really weird conversation because he stops thinking about it at, I'm an artist, I should be able to comment on things in my art, and he's absolutely right.
Yeah.
But just because you can do something, right, that's the whole...
Yeah,
To quote, I think it's... Is it Sam Jackson who says it? No, it's Jeff Goldblum, but Sam Jackson's in Jurassic Park. Like, just because you were so obsessed with the idea of whether you could do it.
You didn't think to with you should.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we
great
end up
line.
With,
great
yeah,
line.
Yeah, it is. And one that you can use in almost any situation.
Yeah.
And so we end up in this weird place where, you made this movie and it's about the thing you wanted it to be about, but it's not what you think it is.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's why I kind of long for stuff like Kill Bill and Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, all the discussions are enclosed. They're in a bubble. It's not real.
Yeah, he's not trying to correct, because the next thing he'll do is stop the 9/11 attacks or something like that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I was going to say global warming.
Yeah,
he'll make a movie about global warming next.
You know, and like, we would all love to go back to that time and stop that from happening. We all would, but it's like, you can't just make a film and pretend it didn't happen. You really need to think about these things. But I feel like, I've only met him once. We had a great chat. He doesn't have a clue who the hell I am. I met him at a thing and we just spoke and we had a great, good 30-40 minute talk when he was just talking to me, but didn't know I was a filmmaker. I'd say I'm a filmmaker.
Are you sure he's seen Dr.
No, no. Oh, maybe.
Quentin Tarantino seems like the kind of guy who'd watch.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe. I'm trying to remember if I met him before I was in that, though. I don't recall.
Mm.
Maybe, sure. But it's just one of those things where you just kind of have to try and always be, just make your art, but be aware. You have to kind of be aware. It's a double-edged sword, isn't it? But that's why, I love Pulp Fiction, because he wasn't trying to correct. It was just, this is what it is.
Yeah.
You know.
It comes back to that thing we were talking about, where if the movie knows it's cool, if the movie knows it's okay to be commenting on it, even if the characters don't.
Yeah.
I'm getting the sense that with Tarantino, he's the character who doesn't know he's not supposed to be doing.
Exactly. Yeah, you're right. You're right. Yeah.
So that puts us in an interesting place with his... I don't even know what the next one is, but I'll still go. I want to see it.
100%.
I'm there for it. So we more or less covered the final question on the show, which is, what of Pulp Fiction have you borrowed or stolen or incorporated into your own DNA? But if there anything else that we didn't touch on?
No, I think, like I said, I've just, I've inherited some of his passion for dialogue that doesn't move the story forward.
Are your running times creeping up? Are we looking at 2.5 hours these days?
Man, then this one is was there in the first cut. I think I've really learned and taken the fact that, you can be good people that do bad things and bad people that do good things, and that life is a lot more complex than we think. And Tarantino did that stuff so well. He had, the most vile characters, but you like them because you start to learn about what they eat for breakfast and you start to learn about their lives and that, people are products of their environment. And I think that, my films kind of do that as well. And hopefully I've stolen a bit of Tarantino's talent, and one day I'll have something that hits on the world stage.
Well, I've really enjoyed watching you develop as a filmmaker. Incredibly condescending.
No, man. But, I think it's the truth, man.
It's been what, 5-6 features?
I've done, I've written directed? Like 8, but I've directed 4.
Only 4?
Yeah, only 4, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I've directed 4. Because I didn't direct Kid Hollywood. I was there every day, but I didn't direct
That's
it.
Right.
Yeah, but I didn't direct it, but I was on set in the next to the director, you know, which gave me the sort of rub to do adulthood and stuff. But,
and what is that like? What's that experience like, having created a thing and being in it, but not fully
it was, you know, in control of it? At the time, it was fine, because I was an actor who wanted to write and wrote one script, and people wanted to make it, and it was getting made. And I remember the director saying, listen, I want you there every day next to me, because you're from this area and you're kind of about that life. And so I was there every day learning, you know, but it was fine. But I think that's put me in good stead, because now I can still write things and give them to other directors and let them put their spin on it and not be like, whoa, hold on a second. You know, I can do that. And I think that kind of helped with that, you know?
Yeah. Well, it always amazes me when I remember that Tarantino started as an actor. Mm. And even before Reservoir Dogs, he did rewrites for a couple of films. There's a movie called Past Midnight with Rutger Hauer. Right. And I want to say Jennifer Jason Leigh, where there are clearly three or four scenes that he rewrote from beginning to end.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden people are talking about detergent and products and coffee machines.
Yeah.
And your ear just rings to it.
Yeah.
And then he gets to do his own thing, and it's utterly different from that, because you can see the conventional world fighting against that script.
Yeah.
And then once he gets behind it and takes care of it, it's Reservoir Dogs. It's perfect.
Yeah.
It's what it wants to be.
Mm. That's interesting.
Did you find, when you were switching from writer-actor to actor-writer-director, was there a similar transition? Did you feel like you had better control? Or? Were you just too busy putting it together to think about it?
Yeah, again, I guess you did. Yeah, the second one, you kind of like, you do feel you have better control once you're in it. But again, you know, it was just that Joker line again. Yeah. I just do things.
Yeah.
You know, there was no sort of, I had a shot list and I prepped, but, you know, not to the level I prep now. It was just about doing stuff. I think the best thing to say, the best way to kind of explain it was, when I made Adulthood, I was a guy that made films.
Right.
When I made Brotherhood, I was a filmmaker. And the progression is evident. You watch the films back to back, you'll be like, you almost won't believe what a mess, not script-wise, story-wise is fine, but like technically and visually, you almost won't remember what a mess. People comment, oh, it's so raw. The rawness is brilliant. And it is, because at the time, I was a guy who didn't know what he's doing.
Right.
But my point is, you almost won't realize the mess that adulthood is technically until you watch it next to Brotherhood, and then you go, "Fuck, that was actually a bit of a mess."
Yeah.
Because the story's so good, you know, and the kind of it works as a through line, it carries it along, yeah. But when you watch it technically next to the other one, it's just kind of a little bit of a mess, you know?
Yeah. See, here I thought you were doing that intentionally.
Yeah.
Because the films are maturing based on the arc of the story.
No, it's just like, no, what shall I do? Oh, let's put a montage here and do it like this. Let's put another one like that, you know? It's kind of, it's all about the learning and, you know?
No, you're being too honest. You have to tell people it was intentional. This is the thing we were talking about.
Yeah, it was intentional, guys.
It's artistic intent is always there.
Yeah, funny. Yeah.
My thanks to Noel Clark, whose new movie Brotherhood is in UK theaters right now and coming to North America in the new year. You can follow Noel on Twitter at Noel Clark, all one word, Clark with an E, and you can find Pulp Fiction on DVD and Blu-ray from Lionsgate Home Entertainment in the US and Entertainment One in Canada. It's also available for sale and rental on iTunes and Google Play, and streaming on Netflix pretty much everywhere you look. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at nowtoronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at someoneelsesmovie.com. If you want to leave a review up on iTunes, that would be very kind of you. This week's call sign is Fox Force 5. Thanks for listening.
I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.